him at times to peek through the keyhole at what was going on. The runt had gotten into two-dimensional sex, magazines and movies. After much prodding, shortly before the internship, he'd begun a relationship with an intellectual poet named June. The poems were sexless, asensual, bone dry. The runt looked diffused. His mustache drooped. As he sat down, he took out a pill box, put a pill on his hamburger, and munched it down. When I asked what it was, he said, "Valium, vitamin V. I've never been so nervous in my life." "Were you on call last night?" "Nope. Tonight. Hooper was on call last night." When I asked Hooper how it had been, he got that same gleam in his eye that he'd gotten at the BM deli when the Pearl told the story about doing the autopsy in secret, and he giggled and said, "Great, just great. Two deaths, one permission for the postmortem. Watched it myself this morning. Fantastic." "Does the Valium help?" Potts asked the runt. "It makes me feel kind of sleepy, but I feel pretty unflappable. I'm writing orders for it for all my patients." "What?" I asked. "You're putting them on Valium, too?" "Why not? They're all very nervous, having me as their doc. By the way, Potts, thanks a lot for that transfer last night, the yellow man," said the runt sarcastically. "Terrific." "I'm sorry," said Potts. "I should have given him the steroids." "Has he stopped convulsing?" "Nope. Not yet." I got beeped to go back to the ward. And as I left, I asked Eat My Dust how it was going for him. "How's it going? Compared to California, it sucks." When the Rokitansky girls asked to speak with me again, I felt grand. Their hearing aids turned up full blast. They asked for the latest bulletin from our brother's doctor. I felt like I was in command, like I had something to give. They hung on my every word. When my beeper called me away, they said they were sorry they'd bothered me and that I must have more important things to do, and as I left them to go down to my first outpatient clinic, I felt a real thrill. When I stepped into the elevator, people looked at me, tried to read my name tag, knowing I was a doc. I was proud of my stethoscope, of the blood on my sleeve. The fat man was a burnt-out case. Being a doc was a thrill. You could do things for people. They had faith in you. You couldn't let them down. Rokitansky would get well. Cocky, seduced by the illusion of somehow getting Rokitansky to regenerate his brain, I entered the outpatient clinic. Chuck and I had our clinics on the same day and, side by side, listened as the clinic was explained. We'd be functioning just like general practitioners, except we wouldn't get paid. We each were given an office to use once every 2 weeks. The final seduction was when they presented each of us with our cards. Roy G. Bash, M.D., Outpatient Clinic, House of God. Bolstered by pride, pretending to know what I was doing, I waded through my first clinic. Too poor to afford a house private, clinic patients would turn out to be of two types. 52-year-old husbandless black mothers with high blood pressure and 72-year-old husbandless Jewish lols in NAD with high blood pressure. I would hardly ever see a male. And to see someone below the age of 52, except for mental disturbance or venereal disease, would be publishable. My first very own patient was a loll in NAD, in need of a checkup and a prescription for a new artificial breast and padded bra with fillable pockets. Who knew how to write a prescription? Not me. She wrote it, I signed it, and grateful, she left. Next was a Portuguese woman who wanted me to do something about her corns. Who knew about corns? I toyed with the idea of writing her a prescription for an artificial foot and a padded shoe with fillable socks, but then I remembered the fat man and turfed her to podiatry. The next loll in NAD was 75, Jewish, and came in with her upper eyelids scotch-taped to her forehead. Reading her old chart, I found out that this was a case of drooping lids of unknown etiology, and that her previous clinic turn had turfed her to ophthalmology, where the resident had told her to tape them up or I operate. And she'd chosen the tape and had been turfed back to medicine. This was a bounce. "Oh, I love meeting all you nice young doctors," she said. "How long have you had this tape on your lids?"
8 years.
"How much longer do I have to wear it?"
"What happens if you take it off?"
"My eyelids fall down." I wrote her a prescription for more tape. She grasped my hand and began to chatter about how glad she was to have me as her doctor. It was hard for me to listen because her taped-up lids made her eyes bulge out like a monster of the deep, and the only thing that stopped her life story from pouring out was that the nurse brought in my next patient, the last of the afternoon. This was a hypertensive black woman of 54 named May, with no chief complaint except, "My joints hurt when I play basketball with my kids," and a request for a pelvic exam. When she was up in the stirrups, May started spouting Jehovah's Witness gospel, and after she got dressed, chattering all the while a mixture of religion, family history, and history of her previous turns at the house clinic, she spewed out some witness pamphlets and left. These women loved coming to the doctor. I walked into Chuck's office and found him with a lull in NAD, too. He was doing something I'd never seen before in medicine, something with a tape measure and a breast.
"Well, you see, man, this lady says her breast is growing.
Just one of them."
"Right. So I thought I'd better measure and see if it gets any bigger in the next 2 weeks."
Back on the ward, I felt grand. I was excited, thrilled at being a doctor. Having been a red-hot in my academic career, there was no reason not to be a house red-hot, too. Hadn't the Pearl himself, earlier in the day, congratulated me on the way I'd cleaned out his patient for the bowel run? Feeling Dr. Kildare-ish, I sat in the warm sunlight of the nursing station. Looking into the room across the hallway, I saw Molly, perky, transparent Molly, bending over the bed, fiddling with the sheet. She kept her legs straight, so her miniskirt rode up her thighs, and with a final reach over to the far side of the bed, she hiked the hem up over her ass, showering me with the rainbow and flower pattern of her little girl panties, snug against the firm, full, gluteal folds that formed an awning over the juicy, female thing that grew up there. I could feel a half-chub mumbling and squirming in my whites.
"That's the straight bend over."
It was the fat man. He sat down beside me, unrolling the journal.
"Huh?
That nursing maneuver, where they bend from the waist and flash their ass? Called the straight bend over nursing maneuver. Learn it in nursing school. What are you going to do about turfing Sophie? She's settling in, and I'm warning you, she's really getting putzled this time. She could be here for months."
"Putzled?"
"Bob Putzel, her private, remember? He uses the standard method. Admit the lull and NAD, do a test, produce a complication, do another test to diagnose the complication, get another complication, and so on until they're gomatose and non-turfable. Do you want a nice lull and NAD to become an Ina Goober? Nip it in the bud. Do something now. You gotta get her to leave."
"How?"
"Do a painful procedure. She doesn't like painful procedures."
"I can't think of anything that's indicated."
"Oh. Well, she has a headache, and her noon temp is a degree high. No matter that it's almost 100 Fahrenheit up here, and all the temps are a degree high, no matter, because the chart is buffed with a recorded noon temp a degree high. Oh, and she has a stiff neck, too, so headache, fever, stiff neck. Diagnosis?
Meningitis.
Procedure.
Lumbar puncture. LP.
But she doesn't really have meningitis."
"She might. If you don't LP her, you might miss it. Like Potts missed with Mellow Yellow. And don't worry about hurting Sophie. She's tough. A gray panther. Get Molly to help."
Looking in the paper, Fats mumbled, "The Dow Jones is up, baby, up. Good. Good climate for the invention now, for sure."
"For what?"
"The invention, the invention. The great American medical invention."
With the Dow Jones rising up over America's colorful ass, how could I not enjoy doing an LP on Sophie? Molly had never before assisted at an LP and was glad to help. Together we walked into Sophie's room. Levy, the lost, my BMS, was sitting on Sophie's bed, putzling her hand, taking a history. He was still at the beginning, asking her, "What brought you to the hospital?"
"What brought me? Dr. Putzel, in his white continental."
I stopped Levy and instructed Molly in how to hold Sophie curled up in a fetal position on her side, exposing her back to me. As Molly bent down over Sophie, grabbing her behind the knees and neck, arms spread apart like Christ on the cross, I noticed that the two top buttons of her ruffled blouse were undone, and I was staring into an enticing cleft between Molly's breasts, bubbling up out of lacy bra cups. She noticed me noticing and said, smiling, "Go ahead." How bizarre, the contrast between these two women. I had an urge to slip my penis into Molly's cleft. Potts popped his head in and asked us if we knew where a Bible could be found.
"A Bible? What on earth for?" asked Molly.
"For pronouncing a patient dead," said Potts, vanishing again. I tried to recall how to do an LP. At BMS, I had been particularly bad at these, and to do an LP on an old person was more difficult, for the ligaments in between the vertebrae are calcified, like guano on an old rock. And then there was the fat. Fat is death to a turn. All the anatomical landmarks get obliterated in fat. And as I tried to locate Sophie's midline with my ill-fitting rubber gloves and the rolling fat, it was impossible. I thought I had it, and as I put the needle in, Sophie screamed and leaped, and as I advanced the needle further, she yelped and leaped again. Molly's hair came loose, a blonde cascade over Sophie's old and sweaty torso. Every time I looked into Molly's cleavage, I got aroused. And every time Levy said something, I got mad and wanted to slug him. And every time I advanced the needle, Sophie leaped up in pain. I began to sweat. I tried another spot on Sophie's fat back. No luck. Another. Nothing. I noticed that blood was coming out of the spinal needle, so I knew it wasn't where it was supposed to be. Where was it? Lubricated by the sweat, my glasses fell off and contaminated the sterile field. Molly let go at the same time. Sophie uncoiled and looked like she was about to go to ground from just below the orthopedic height, but we caught her in time. Embarrassed, my cockiness splattered in sweat all over Sophie, I told Levy to stop smirking and get the fat man. Fats came in two shakes had Molly expose herself and Sophie's porcine back, and humming a TV commercial that sounded like I wish I were an Oscar Mayer wiener with a smooth and effortless Sam Snead stroke, sliced through the fat and popped into the subarachnoid space. I was amazed at his virtuosity. We watched the clear spinal fluid drip out. Fats took me aside and, like a coach, put his arm around my shoulders and whispered, "You were way off the midline. You hit either kidney or gut. Pray kidney, 'cause if it's gut, it's infection city and she may suffer the ultimate turf to pathology."
Pathology?
The morgue. No bounce. But I think it worked. "Listen, I want to go home. I want to go home. I want to..." I began to feel scared that I had started an infection that would send Sophie home for good. As if in confirmation, from the next bed, behind the curtain, Potts was dealing with his first death. His patient, the young father who dropped on the first base line the day before, had died. Potts had been called to pronounce the patient dead, as required by law. We peeked through the curtain. Potts was standing at the foot of the bed, his BMS beside him holding a Bible on which rested Potts's hand. His other hand was raised toward the body, which was lying there as white as a corpse, which was what it was. As we watched, Potts intoned, "By the power vested in me by this great state and nation, I hereby pronounce you, Elliot Reginald Needleman, dead. Molly, snuggling up to me so that her left breast brushed my arm, asked, "Is that really necessary?" And I said I didn't know. And I asked Fats, who said, "Of course not. The only federal regulation is that you take the 2 pennies out of your loafers and put them over the dead man's eyes." Potts, decimated, sat with us at the nursing station. Slurring his words, his eyes bloodshot, he said, "He's dead. Maybe I should have shipped him to surgery sooner. I should have done something. But I was so tired when he came in, I couldn't even think." "You did all you could," I said. "He popped an aneurysm. Nothing would have helped. The surgeons refused to operate." "Yeah. They said it was too late. If I had moved faster, maybe."
"Enough of that," said the fat man. "Potts, you listen to me. There's a law you've got to learn. Law number 4. The patient is the one with the disease. Understand?"
Before he had a chance to understand, we were both interrupted by the chief resident, the fish. He had a concerned look on his face. It turned out that both Needleman and the yellow man were not private patients, but house patients, and the fish was partially responsible. "Liver disease is a special interest of mine," said the fish. "I've recently had the opportunity to review the world literature on fulminant necrotic hepatitis. Why, the case of Laszlo would make a very interesting research project. Perhaps the house staff would wish at some point to undertake such a project." No one said he wanted to undertake such a project. "However, both the Lego and I feel, Dr. Potts, that you waited too long without giving steroids. Do you understand?"
Stabbed, Potts said, "Yes, you're right. I understand.
I'm on my way to an impromptu colloquium on Laszlo. We've brought in the Australian, the world's expert on this disease. It does not look good. You waited too long." "Oh, and one more thing," said the fish, looking at Chuck's dirty whites and unbuttoned shirt without a tie. "The way you dress, Chuck. Not professional. Not enough for the house. Clean whites here, and a tie. Understand?"
"Fine, fine," said Chuck.
"And you, Roy," said the fish, pointing to the cigarette I'd just lit up. "Enjoy that, because it will prove to be 3 minutes off your life." I saw red. The fish slid off down the corridor to the colloquium. A morbid silence coated us. The fat man broke it, spitting out, "Jerk! Now, just remember this, Potts. If you want to end up like that jerk, you'll believe him. If not, you'll listen to me. The patient is the one with the disease."
"Are you really going to dress better?" I asked Chuck.
"Course not, man, course not. In Memphis, we don't even wear neckties to funerals." "Man, these Gomers are something else. None of my 4 admissions so far believes I'm really their doctor. They all think I'm the hep."
"Hep?"
"H-E-L-P. Hep. The colored hep." "See you later." Staring out the windows, Potts muttered to himself something about how he should have given the yellow man the roids. But the fat man stopped him, saying, "Potts, go home."
"Home? Charleston. You know, right now my brother, he's in construction. He's probably lying out in a hammock on Pawley's Island, sipping a fizz. Or maybe upcountry, where it's all green and cool. I never should have left. The fish is right in what he said, but if this was the South, he never would have said it. Not like that. My mother has a word for him. Common. Guess I made my choice, though, didn't I? Well, I will go home. Thank God Otis is at home.
Where's your wife?"
"She's on call tonight at the MBH. It'll be just Otis and me. That's just fine, 'cause he loves me too. He'll be lying there on the bed with his balls up in the air, snoring. It'll be good to go home to him. See you tomorrow."
We watched Potts stumble on down the hallway. He came to the colloquium outside the room containing the yellow man. Without looking in, as if ashamed, Potts slunk past them and out the door. "This is crazy," I said to the fat man. "This internship is nothing like what I thought it would be. What do we do for these patients anyway? They either die or we buff and turf them to some other part of the house."
"That's not crazy. That's modern medicine."
"I don't believe it. Not yet."
"Of course you don't. You'd be crazy to. It's only your second day. Wait till tomorrow when you and me are on call together. Well, I'm going home. Pray for the Dow Jones bash. Pray the fucker stays on up."
Who cared?
I finished my work and walked down the corridor toward the elevator. The crowd around the Australian expert was breaking up, and out of it rolled the runt. He looked a lot worse. I asked him what was going on, and he said, "The Australian said we should do an exchange transfusion, where you take all the old blood out and replace it with new."
"That never works. The blood still has to go through the liver, and there is no liver. He's going to die."
"Yeah, that's what they all said, too, but since he's young and was walking around yesterday, they think it's worth a try. They said I had to do it, tonight, and I'm scared stiff."
Screams came from the room. The yellow man was flopping up and down on the bed like a hooked tuna, screaming. A member of housekeeping ambled up, pushing two huge carts laden with linen, gowns, operating room garb, and large polyethylene bags labeled "Danger, Contaminated." The head nurse told the runt that the blood would be ready in half an hour, and that there was only one nurse to assist since the others were scared of sticking themselves with a needle and catching the fatal disease. They refused to work in the room. The runt and I watched the nurse walk away, and watched housekeeping, whistling, disappear into the down elevator. The runt looked up at me with terror in his eyes, and then put his head on my shoulder, and cried. I didn't know what to do. I would have volunteered to help, but I was scared of catching whatever bad thing it was that had you walking around chatting up the tit one day and convulsing like a hooked tuna the next.
Do one thing for me, said the runt. If I die, take the money in my trust fund and donate it to the BMS. Make a prize for the member of the class who first realizes the insanity of this business and drops out to do something else.
I helped him on with his sterile operating room garb, his gloves, face mask, hat. Like an astronaut, he launched himself with an awkward shuffle into the room, up to the bed, and started the procedure. The bags of fresh blood began to arrive. With a lump in my throat, I walked out, down the corridor. The cries, smells, bizarre sights riddled my head like bullets in a nightmare war. Even though I hadn't touched the yellow man, I went to the bathroom and gave myself a long surgical scrub. I felt terrible. I liked the runt, and he was going to poke himself with a contaminated needle, catch this liver-ripping hepatitis, turn yellow, flip like a gaffed fish, and die. And for what? As if in a tank full of water, I listened to Barry while I read my father's latest letter. By now you must be in the middle of your work, and it will settle down to a routine. I know that there is so much to learn, and you will be immersed in it. Medicine is a great profession, and it is a wonderful thing to be able to heal the sick. I played 18 on Saturday in the heat, and it was made bearable by a gallon of iced tea and a birdie on number. Unlike my father, Barry was not as interested in preserving an illusion of medicine as she was in understanding my experience. She asked me what it had been like, and although I tried to tell her, I realized that it had not been like anything, and I could not. But what made it so hard? The fatigue? Nope. I think what made it hard was the Gomers and the fat man.
Tell me about it, love.
I told her how I couldn't decide whether or not what the fat man taught about medicine was crazy. The more I saw, the more sense the fat man made. I had begun to think I was crazy for thinking he was crazy. As an example, I told Barry about the Gomers and about how we'd laughed at Ina in her ram's helmet socking pots with her purse. Calling old people Gomers sounds like a defense. Gomers aren't just old people. The fat man says he loves old people, and I believe him, because he gets tears in his eyes when he talks about his grandmother and her matzo balls that you eat sitting on ladders, scraping them off the ceiling. Laughing at this, Ina is sick. It does seem sick right now. But it didn't then. Why did you laugh at her? I don't know. It was hilarious at the time. I'd like to understand. Try again. Nope. I can't. Try to snap out of it, Roy, please. No, I don't want to think about it anymore. I shut up. She got mad. She couldn't have known that all I wanted then was to be taken care of. Things had moved fast. 2 days, and already, like swimming in a strong current, I'd looked up and found my life an eternity farther downstream, the near bank far gone. A rift had opened up. Up until then, Barry and I had been in the same world, outside the house of God. Now, for me, the world was inside the house, with the yellow man my age and the runt both about to crump, with the dead father my age who'd popped an aneurysm playing baseball, with the privates, the slurpers, and the gomers, and with Molly. Molly knew what a gomer was, and why we'd laughed. With Molly, so far, there had been no talk. There'd been only the straight bendovers, the clefts, and the full round hollows, the red nails and blue lids and panties splashed with flowers and rainbows, and the laughter amidst the gomers and the dead. Molly was the promise of a breast against an arm. Molly was recess. Yet Molly was recess from much that I loved. I didn't want to laugh at patience. If it really were as hopeless as the fat man said, I'd give up now. I didn't like this rift with Barry. And so, thinking to myself that the fat man really was bananas after all, and that somehow if I believed him I'd lose Barry, I said, "You're right. It's sick to laugh at the old people. I'm sorry." For an instant I saw myself as a real doc, rushing in and saving lives, and Barry and I sighed together and snuggled together and got undressed together and were together in love together, tight and warm wet, and that portending rift sealed over again. She slept. I lay awake, afraid of my tomorrow, my upcoming first night on call. Chapter 5. When I went to wake Chuck up the next morning, he looked wrecked. His afro smushed down over one side of his head, his face scarred from the wrinkles of the sheets, the white of one eye red, and the other eye swollen shut. "What happened to your eye?"
"Bug bite. Bug fucking bite, right in my eye. There's some fierce kind of bug in this on-call room."
"Your other eye looks terrible, too."
"Man, you should see it from this side. I called housekeeping for some clean sheets, but you know how it is. I never answered calls neither before those postcards started arriving. There's only one way to handle housekeeping, man, and I'm gonna do it."
"What's that?"
"Love. The boss of bedmaking is named Hazel. She's a big Cuban woman. I know I could love her."
In the card flip, Potts asked Chuck how it had gone.
"Great. 6 admissions. The youngest 74.
"What time did you get to sleep?"
"Midnight."
Amazed, Potts asked,
"How? How'd you ever get the write-ups done?"
"Easy, man. Shitty write-ups, man. Shitty write-ups."
"Key concept," said the fat man, "to think that you're doing a shitty job. If you resign yourself to doing a shitty job, you go ahead and get the job done, and since we're all in the 99th percentile of interns at one of the best internships in the world, what you do turns out to be a terrific job, a superlative job. Don't forget that 4 out of every 10 interns in America can't speak English."
"So it wasn't so bad, Chuck?" I asked hopefully.
"Bad? Oh, it was bad. Man, last night I was used."
My worst warning was the runt. As I'd walked into the house that morning,
deflated by the transition from the bright and healthy July to the diseased neon and a-seasonal stink of the corridor, I'd passed the room of the yellow man. Outside it were bags marked Danger, Contaminated, now full of blood-stained sheets, towels, scrub suits, and equipment. The room was covered with blood. A special duty nurse, wrapped like a spacewoman in sterile clothes, was sitting as far from the body as possible, reading Better Homes and Gardens. The yellow man lay still. Absolutely still. The runt was nowhere to be seen. It wasn't until lunch that I was to see him. It was cigar ash gray. Eat My Dust Eddie and Hyper Hooper led him to the lunch table like a dog on a leash. As he put his tray down, we noticed there was nothing on it but silverware. No one pointed that out. "I'm going to die," said the runt, taking out his pillbox. "You are not going to die," said Hooper. "You are never going to die." The runt told us about the exchange transfusion, about taking the old blood out of one vein and putting the new blood into another. Things were going pretty well, and then I'd taken a needle out of the groin and was about to put it into the last bag of blood, and that porpoise, Celia the nurse, well, she held up this other needle from the yellow man's belly and stuck it in my hand. There was a dead silence. The runt was going to die. All of a sudden, I felt faint. I saw my life ebb past me. Celia said, "Gee, I'm sorry," and I said, "Aw, shucks, it's all right, it just means I'm going to die, and Mellow Yellow's 21, and I'm 27, and I've already lived 6 more years than him, and I've spent my last night doing something I knew was completely worthless, and we'll die together, him and me, but it's okay, Celia." The runt paused, and then screamed, "Hear me, Celia, it's okay! I went to bed at 4 a.m., and I was sure I'd never wake up. But the incubation period is 4 to 6 months. So in 4 months, one of you will exchange transfuse me." "It's all my fault," said Potts. "I should have hit him with steroids." After the others had left, the runt turned to me and said he had a confession to make. "It's about my third admission last night. In the middle of all this crap with the yellow man, this guy comes into the emergency room, and I couldn't handle it. I offered him $5 if he'd go home. He took it and left." Prodded by my fear of its arrival, my time to be left alone on call arrived. Potts signed out his patients to me and went home to Otis. Scared, I sat at the nursing station, watching the sad sun die. I thought of Barry and wished I was with her, doing things that young ones like us were supposed to be doing while we still had our health. My fear mushroomed. Chuck came up, signed out his patients, and asked me, "Hey, man, notice anything different?" I did not. "My beeper, man, it's off. They can't get me now." I watched him walk down the long corridor. I wanted to call out to him, "Don't go. Don't leave me alone here." But I did not. I felt so lonesome I wanted to cry. The fat man, earlier in the afternoon, as I'd gotten more and more nervous, had tried to reassure me, telling me that I was lucky, that he'd be on call with me all night. "Besides," he'd said, "tonight's a great night. It's the Wizard of Oz and Blintzes." "The Wizard of Oz and Blintzes?" I asked. "What's that?" "You know, the tornado, the yellow brick road, and that terrific tin man trying to get into Dorothy's pants. Great flick. And at the 10 o'clock meal, Blintzes. We'll have a ball." That hadn't helped me much. As I tended to the chaos of the ward, handling the now hydrated and violent Ina Goober, and tending to the feverish Sophie, who by now was so out of it from the LP that she'd attacked Putzel, I almost trembled with fear of what was to come. And then, when my time came, I choked. I was on the toilet, and from 6 flights down, in her communications bunker, the page operator scored a direct hit. "Dr. Bash, call emergency ward for an admission. Dr. Bash." Someone was dying in the EW, and they wanted me? Didn't they know not to come into a teaching hospital in the first week of July?
They wouldn't see a doctor. They would see me. What did I know?
I panicked. Olaf's potato started to zing through my mind again, and heart pounding, I sought out the fat man, who was in the TV room immersed in The Wizard of Oz. Nibbling at a salami, he was singing along with the flick.
Because of the wonderful things he does, we're off to see the wizard, the wonderful Wizard of Oz.
It was difficult to interrupt him. I thought it peculiar that he'd take an interest in something as playful as Oz, but I soon found out that his interest was, like many of his interests, perverted.
"Do it," Fats muttered. "Do it to Dorothy with the oil can. Spin her around on your hat, Ray. Spin her around on your hat."
"I've got something to tell you," I said.
"Shoot."
"There's a patient, an admission, in the emergency ward."
"Good. Go see her. You're a doctor now, remember? Doctors see patients." "Do it, Ray Bulger. Do it to her, stat."
"Yeah, I know," I squeaked. "But I... you see, someone's going to be dying down there, and I..." Taking his eyes off the tube, Fats looked at me and said in a kind voice, "Oh, I see. Scared, huh?" I nodded and told him that all I could think of was Olaf's big potato.
"Right. Okay. So you're scared. Who isn't his first night on call? Even I was scared. Let's go. We gotta hurry. We've only got a half hour till the 10 o'clock meal."
"What nursing home is she from?"
"I don't know," I said as we walked to the elevator.
"You don't know?
Damn. They've probably already sold her bed, so we won't be able to turf her back there. One of the true medical emergencies when the nursing home sells the Gomer's bed."
"How do you know it will be a Gomer?"
"The odds. Just playing the odds."
The elevator opened, and there was the 6 North turn. Eat My Dust Eddie, standing with a stretcher on which was piled his very own first EW admission. 300 pounds of flesh, naked but for dirty underpants, huge herniations of his abdominal wall, a great medicine ball of a head with little slots for eyes, nose, and mouth, and a bald skull covered with purplish, crisscrossing neurosurgical scars so it looked like a box of Purina dog chow. And all of it was convulsing.
"Roy," said Eat My Dust. "Meet Max."
"Hi, Max," I said.
"Hi, John. Hi, John. Hi, John," said Max.
"Max perseverates," said EMD. "They unhooked his frontal lobe."
"Parkinson's disease for 63 years," said Fats. "A house record. Max comes in when his bowels get blocked. See that intestine pushing its way out through the scars in his belly? Those lumps?"
"We did."
"If you x-ray it, you'll find its feces. Last time Max was here, it took 9 weeks to clean him out, and the only thing that finally worked was a small-handed female Japanese cellist, who was also a BMS student, equipped with special long-armed gynecological gloves, and promised the internship of her choice if she would disimpact Max manually. Want to hear fix the lump?"
"We did."
"Max," said Fats, "what do you want us to do?"
"Fix the lump, fix the lump, fix the lump," said Max.
Eat My Dust Eddie and his BMS put their shoulders to the wheels of the stretcher, and Max, gathering momentum, rolled off into the neon sunset.
Yoked together, the three looked like they were trudging around a ring of the Mountain of Purgatory.
Coming back to my senses as we rode the elevator down, I asked the fat man how come he seemed to know all the patients, like Max, Ina, and Mr. Rokitansky.
"There is a finite number of house Gomers," said Fats, "and since Gomers don't die, they rotate through the house several times a year. It's almost as if they get their yearly schedules in July, just like us. You get to know them by their particular shrieks."
"But what diseases does your Gomer have?"
"I don't know. I haven't seen her yet."
"Doesn't matter. Pick an organ. Any organ."
I fell silent, so scared that I was having trouble thinking of an organ.
"What is this? Where did they get you from? On quota? Is there affirmative action for Jews? What lies inside the chest cavity and beats?"
"The heart."
"Good.
So the Gomer has congestive heart failure. What else?
The lungs.
Terrific. You're really cooking now. Pneumonia. Your Gomer has CHF and pneumonia. She's septic from her indwelling catheter, refuses to eat, wants to die, is demented, and has an unobtainable BP. What's the first thing, the crucial thing, to do?
I thought of the diagnosis of septic shock and suggested an LP.
Nope. That's BMS textbook. Forget textbook. I am your textbook. Nothing you learned at the BMS will help you tonight. Listen. Key concept. Law number 5. Placement comes first.
I think that's going a little too far. I mean, you're making all kinds of assumptions about this person. You're treating a human being like a piece of baggage.
Oh, I'm crass and cruel and cynical again, am I? I don't feel anything for the ill. Well, I do. I cry at movies. I've spent 27 Passovers being pampered by the sweetest grandma any Brooklyn boy ever had. But a Gomer in the house of God is something else.
You'll find out for yourself tonight.
We stood at the nursing station of the EW. Several others were sitting there. Howard Greenspoon, who was the new turn on call in the EW, and 2 policemen. Howard I'd known from the BMS. He was blessed with 2 traits which were to prove to be so useful to him in medicine. Unawareness of self and unawareness of others. Not smart, Howard had slurped his way through BMS and into the house by doing something with urine, either putting urine through computers or running computers on urine. This had endeared him to that other man of little urine, the Lego. A plotter and a planner, Howard was also into using IBM computer cards to aid in medical decision-making. By the start of the internship, he already had developed a terrific bedside manner to hide his rampant indecisiveness. Although Howard wanted to present the case to Fats and me, Fats ignored him, focusing on the policeman. One policeman was huge, barrel-shaped, with red hair growing out of and into most of the slitty features on his fat, red face. The other policeman was a matchstick, decked out facially in white of skin and black of hair, with vigilant eyes and a large, worrisome mouth filled with many disparate teeth. "I'm Sergeant Gilhini," said the red barrel-shaped one, "Fintan Gilhini. And this is Officer Quick. Dr. Roy G. Bash, we wish you hello and shalom."
"You don't look Jewish," I said.
"You don't have to be Jewish to love a hot pumpernickel bagel. And besides, the Jews and the Irish are similar in one respect."
"What respect is that?"
"In their respect for the family unit and the concomitant fucked-up nature of their lives."
Howard, irritated at being ignored, tried to tell us again about my admission.
The fat man silenced him at once.
"But you don't know anything about her," said Howard.
"Tell me her shriek, and I'll know it all."
"Her what?"
"Her shriek. Whatever sound she makes."
"Well," said Howard, "she does shriek. She makes a rudel."
"Anna O," said Fats, "Hebrew house for the incurables. This admission will be approximately number 86. You start with 160 milligrams of the diuretic Lasix, and you go up from there."
"How do you know all that?" asked Howard.
Ignoring him, Fats turned to the policeman and said, "It's obvious that Howard has failed to do the most important things in the case. I trust that you 2 gentlemen have..."
"Even in our role as policemen who patrol the city and environs of the House of God, and often sit and chat and drink coffee with the brilliant young medicos," said Gilhini, "we do sometimes intervene in emergency patient care."
"We are men of the law," said Quick, "and we followed the house law. Placement comes first," and called the Hebrew house. "Alas, during the ambulance ride here, Anna O's bed was sold."
"Too bad," said the fat man.
"Well, at least Anna O is a great one to learn on. She's taught countless house turns medicine. Roy, go see her. You've got 20 minutes till the 10 o'clock meal. I'll wait here and jabber with our friends the cops."
"Magnificent," said the red-headed policeman, beaming a grand, sunny smile. "For 20 minutes of fat man chat is a gift horse we shall look everywhere but in the mouth." I asked Gilheeny why he and Quick were so well informed about this medical emergency, and his reply puzzled me. Would we be policemen if we were not? I left the fat man and the two policemen huddling together, intensifying their chatter. I went to the door of room 116, and once again I felt alone and afraid. Taking a deep breath, I went in. The walls were covered with green tile, and the bright neon light glittered off the stainless steel equipment. It was as if I had stepped into a tomb, for there was no doubt that here, somehow, I was in touch with that poor thing, death. In the center of the room was a stretcher. In the center of the stretcher was Anna O. She lay motionless, her knees bent up toward the ceiling, her shoulders curved around toward her knees, so that her head, unsupported and rigid, almost touched her thighs. From the side, she looked like the letter W. Was she dead? I called to her. No answer. I felt for a pulse. No pulse. Heartbeat? None. Breath? No. She was dead. How fitting that in her death her entire body should have hooked around in a mimicry of her persecuted Jewish nose. I felt relieved that she was dead, that the pressure to care for her was off. I saw her little tuft of white hair, and I remembered my grandmother lying in her coffin, and I was filled with sadness for that loss. A lump formed in my midsection, tugged at the tip of my heart, and pulled itself into my throat. I felt that strange sensation of gritty warmth that comes just before tears. My lower lip curled down. To control myself, I sat. The fat man rushed in and said, "All right, Bash, Blintzes, and... Hey, what's the matter with you?" "She's dead." "Who's dead?" "This poor woman, Anna O." "Baloney, have you lost your mind?" I said nothing to this. Perhaps I had lost my mind, and the strange policeman and the Gomer were all a hallucination. Sensing my sadness, the fat man sat down next to me. "Have I steered you wrong so far?" "You're too cynical. But whatever you say seems to be true, even though it's crazy." "Exactly. So listen to me, and I'll tell you when to cry, because there are times during this turnship when you'll have to cry. And if you don't cry then, you'll jump off this building and they'll scrape you up from the parking lot and drip you into a plastic bag. You'll wind up a bag full of goo. Get it?" I said I did. "But I'm telling you that now is not the time, because this Anna O is a true Gomer, and law number one, Gomers don't die."
"But she's dead. Just look at her."
"Oh, she looks dead. Sure, I'll give you that."
"She is dead."
I called to her and felt for a pulse and listened for a heartbeat and looked for a breath. Nothing. Dead. "With Anna, you need the reverse stethoscope technique. Watch." The fat man took off his stethoscope, plugged the earpiece into Anna O's ears, and then, using the bell like a megaphone, shouted into it, "Cochlea, come in! Cochlea, come in! Do you read me? Cochlea, come..." Suddenly the room exploded. Anna O was rocketing up and down on the stretcher, shrieking at great pitch and intensity, "Rudy-rudy-rudy-rudal!" The fat man plucked his stethoscope from her ears, snatched my hand, and pulled me out of the room. The shrieks echoed through the EW, and Howard at the nursing station stared at us. Seeing him, Fats yelled, "Cardiac arrest, room 116. And as Howard jumped up and came running, the fat man, laughing, pulled me into the elevator and punched the cafeteria button. Beaming, he said, "Repeat after me. Gomers don't die. Gomers don't die." "You betcha. Let's eat." Few things could have been more disgusting than watching the fat man shovel day-old blintzes into his mouth, talking all the time about things as different as the porno motif in Oz, the virtues of the foul food we were eating, and finally, when he and I were left alone, his prospects in what he still would refer to only as the great American medical invention.
I drifted off and was soon with Barry on a June beach, filled with love's excitement, of possibility shared. Capability Brown, English landscapes, eye within eye, sea salt on our caressing lips.
Bash, cut it out. You stay there much longer, and when you come back to this shithole, you'll snap.
How had he known? What had they done to me, putting me with this madman?
I'm not crazy, said Fats. It's just that I spell out what every other doc feels, but most squash down and let eat away at their guts. Last year, I lost weight.
Me.
So I said to myself, not your gastric mucosa, Fats, baby, not for what they're paying you, no ulcer for you. And here I am.
Sated, he mellowed, and went on.
Look, Roy, these Gomers have a terrific talent. They teach us medicine. You and I are going down there, and with my help, Anna O is going to teach you more useful medical procedures in 1 hour than you could learn from a fragile young patient in a week. Law number 6, there is no body cavity that cannot be reached with a number 14 needle and a good strong arm. You learn on the Gomers, so that when some young person comes into the house of God dying, my heart skipped a beat. You know what to do. You do good, and you save them. That part of it's exciting. Wait till you feel the thrill of sticking a needle blindly into a chest to make a diagnosis, to save someone young. I'm telling you, it's fantastic. Let's go. We did. With the fat man's guidance, I learned how to tap a chest, tap a knee, put in lines, do an LP properly, and many other invasive procedures. He was right. As I got better with the needle, I began to feel good, more confident, and the possibility that I might become a competent doc glowed inside me. Fear began to leave me, and when I realized what was happening, I felt, deep inside, a blush, a rush, a thrill. All right, said Fats. So much for diagnosis. Now, treatment. What do we do for her heart failure? How much Lasix?
Who knew? BMS had taught me nothing about the empirics of treatment.
Law number 7. Age plus bun equals Lasix dose.
This was nonsense. Although the bun, blood, urea, nitrogen, was an indirect measure of heart failure, it was clear that Fats was playing another joke, and I said, that equation is nonsense.
Of course it is. And it works every time.
Anna is 95 and her bun is 80. 175 milligrams. 25 to grow on and it's an even 200.
Do what you like, but she'll start to piss only when you get to 200.
Oh, and remember, Bash, buff her chart. Litigation is nasty, so put a good shiny buff on Anna O's chart.
Okay, I said, but do I have to get her out of heart failure before I start her bowel run?
Bowel run? Are you nuts? She's not a private patient. She's your patient. There's no bowel run on her. Feeling grateful, feeling glad that this medical wizard was with me, I said, you know what you are, Fats?
What?
You're a great American. And with luck, soon a rich one.
Bedtime for Fats.
Remember, Roy, primum non nocere. And hasta la vista, motherfucker. Of course, he was right. As I wrote up my admissions from the day, buffing the charts, I tried lower doses of Lasix on Anna. And nothing happened. I sat at the nursing station, listening to the cooings of the Gomers, punctuated by the bleep, bleep of the cardiac monitors. It had a soothing lullaby quality. Bleep, bleep. Fix the lump. Bleep, bleep. Roodle, roodle. Bleep, bleep. Fix the lump. Bleep, bleep. Roodle, roodle. Goive, roodle, roodle. Fix the lump. Bleep, bleep. Bleep, bleep. Les Brown and his Gomer band of renown serenading me as I awaited Anna O's pee. At 175, she trickled. And at 200, she gushed. It was crazy.
Nevertheless, seeing the urine, like a new father, my chest puffed with pride. I announced the event to Molly.
Golly, Roy, that's terrific. You're going to get that nice old lady back on her feet.
Great. Have a good night's sleep.
I'll be here. We'll take care of things together. I've got a lot of confidence in you. Happy 4th of July.
I looked at my watch. It was 2 a.m. on the magnificent 4th. Feeling good, feeling proud and competent, I walked down the empty corridor to the on-call room. Power trip. I was in charge of all this. I felt a chill go through me, like the intern in the book. Far out. The bed was unmade, and I couldn't find any surgical pajamas, and Levy, the lost BMS, was snoring in the top bunk. But I was so tired, who cared? As I headed toward my dreams, listening to the bleep, bleep, I mused on cardiac arrests. And as my mind covered all I knew about cardiac arrests, I was soon left with all I didn't know. I started to worry. I couldn't sleep, because any minute I might be called to an arrest. What would I do? I felt a nudge. And there was Molly. She put a finger to her lips to signal silence. She sat on the bottom bunk and took off her white nursing shoes and pulled down her white pantyhose and bikini panties. She lifted the covers and said something about not wanting to get her uniform wrinkled and sat, cross-legged, on top of me. She unbuttoned her front and bent over and kissed me full on the lips. And as I put my palm round her glassy ass, her perfume... There was a tap on my shoulder. Perfume. I turned my head toward the tap and found myself looking straight up into Molly's thighs as she squatted down to awaken me. Damn, it had been a dream. But this was not. It really was going to happen. She put her hand on my shoulder. Jesus, but wasn't she going to leap into the sack with me after all? I was wrong. It was about a patient, one of Little Otto's cardiac cases, who refused to lie quietly in her restraints. Trying to hide the stiff, screaming crowd living it up in my white pants, I stumbled out into the corridor, blinking in the glare, and followed that pert, bouncing ass to the patient's room. There was an explosion. We ran in to find the woman having gone to ground, standing naked in the middle of her room, screaming obscenities at her own reflection in the mirror. She picked up an IV bottle, screamed, "There! There! That old woman in the mirror!" and hurled the bottle at her reflection, smashing the mirror to bits. When she saw me, she knelt in the broken glass, grabbed my knees, and said, "Please, mister, please don't send me home." It was pathetic. She smelled stale. We tried to cool her off. We roped her back into restraints. This was the first of a series of explosions to mark the 4th. When I called Little Otto to tell him that his patient was living it up, Otto exploded, accusing me of worrying my patient with your inept attention. She's a nice woman, and you must have upset her. Leave her alone! Next, the elevator door opened, and exploding out of yet another ring of hell, out rolled Eat My Dust and his BMS, wheeling yet another human carcass to the far end of the hall. This one was a bony mollusk of a man with a red knobby protuberance popping out of his skull, sitting as rigid as a corpse, chanting, "Ruggala, ruggala, ruggala, rug. Ruggala, 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 gug." "This is my 4th admission," said Eddie, "and it means that you're up next. You should see what they're cooking up in the EW now." Next up? Inconceivable. I went back to bed and I fell asleep. Until my finger, celebrating the 4th on its own, exploded in pain. I screamed at the top of my voice, bringing Levy down from the top bunk and Molly in from the ward, pushing those fun thighs into my puss. "Something bit me!" I shrieked. "Honest, Dr. Bash," said Levy, "I swear it wasn't me." My finger started to swell. The pain was excruciating. "I was going to call you anyway," said Molly. "There's another admission for you in the EW. "Oh, no. I can't stand another Gomer tonight." "Not a Gomer. 50 and sick.
He's a doctor himself.
Fighting panic, I went to the EW. I read the chart. Dr. Sanders, 51, black, on the House of God staff. Previous history of parotid and pituitary tumors with horrible complications. Came in this time with chest pain, increasing weight loss, lethargy, difficulty breathing. Should I call